Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. Or welcome if you are here for the first time. It's wonderful to have you here. My name is Ellen Jackson, and I am your host, and I am feeling particularly relaxed and refreshed today, having returned from a week's holiday. Far from work and worries, and in fact so far away that there was no Wi-Fi, no internet access and no mobile phone coverage. And I have to tell you that despite knowing that getting away and disconnecting from the world is important for our health and well-being, I am just like everybody else, I guess. I don't always follow my own good advice, but when I do, I remember how clear your mind can become, how you're able to just shed all of those things that pop around, you know, every time that you think, oh, I don't know the answer to that, I'll Google it. Or I wonder if that bill's coming up, I'll just check my phone or my finance app, or just the habitual checking of email to see if anything's popped up, or see what somebody's posted on Facebook. Those habits that become so much part of our everyday, and when we're forced to disconnect, and I must admit I'm one of those people who does need to be physically removed to a place where I am forced to disconnect, it really is just so refreshing, and it just gives your mind a little chance to calm down. You get into a habit of not thinking about those things or not having those niggly little worries and ideas and thoughts just pinging around in your mind all the time. So instead of checking my email or checking things on my phone, I was unable to do any of that. I cycled and I swam and I spent time with family and I ate way too much and I snorkeled and I played tennis and we did jigsaws, and it really was infinitely more relaxing. That's one of the things that I perhaps didn't learn, but was certainly reminded of this week. So I would encourage you, if you get the opportunity, to take a break from your devices, from your work, from your email, from all of that connectivity to the things that keep our minds busy every day. Highly recommended. There's something else that I learned this week that I'd like to share with you, and that is an opportunity. It's an opportunity just for you, particularly if you are interested in learning more about positive psychology, perhaps in a more formal sense, without having to take the time to go off to university and do some further study. And not only do you get this opportunity to learn, you get an opportunity to learn from someone who taught me, Dr. Susie Green, who was not only my lecturer at the University of Sydney quite some years ago, she was also a guest in the first season of the podcast, and her signature online course launches for the first time very soon. It's called The Positivity Prescription, and it's an 8-week online program. It's designed to help you flourish, and it's based on the science of positive psychology. And Susie really is an international expert in the field. The Positivity Prescription program consists of 6 core modules based on Susie Green's 6M model of flourishing. And in each, there are videos, there are articles, there are weekly challenges for you to complete in which you actually experiment with positive psychology practice in your own life. And these are all things that have been scientifically tried and tested to help improve your well-being, increase your resilience and your optimism, and help you thrive and flourish. Susie will also conduct a weekly 1-hour live in the lab session to discuss what was explored in each module and provide you any assistance that you might need on the topic for that week. And there's a Class of 2018 Facebook group that she's going to manage as well. So you have plenty of personal access to Susie, as well as modules chock full of scientifically backed resources, knowledge, articles, tips, skills, challenges, everything you could possibly need. If you're keen to find out more, and I encourage you to do so, you can pop over to the Positivity Institute website and their online shop. It's at www.thepositivityinstitute.com.au/shop_PI. But I'm sure if you head over to their homepage at thepositivityinstitute.com.au, you can find the shop there in the navigation bar. So I think it's time to introduce my guest for today. And here's a little treat for you. Have a listen to this. Is the beautiful playing of my guest today. Anastasia Hironas is a clinical psychologist, music teacher, concert pianist, and performance coach. And Anastasia is based in Sydney, where she works as a clinical psychologist with children, adolescents, and adults with a range of mental health concerns. She also works as a music teacher and coach, running lessons and masterclass workshops for musicians, and she's currently completing her PhD. Anastasia has performed as a soloist at the Sydney Opera House 7 times, and in 2015, after winning an international music competition, she performed at Carnegie Hall in New York. Anastasia is a very experienced performer, and that's what we're talking about today. She's here to talk to us about the psychological side of performance. Welcome, Anastasia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on the show.
I'm excited to be able to talk to you about this because we seem to have a little performance theme going with the podcast. It wasn't necessarily planned this way. I'd like to say I had it planned. It wasn't necessarily planned this way, but I have been talking so far this season to experts in performance, particularly around sports and elite athletes. So to be able to speak to somebody from a performance perspective in an entirely different realm, in the realm of music, I think makes a really lovely addition to the series. So, can I start by asking you, what has being a concert pianist and a psychologist taught you about performance?
Yeah, it has actually taught me so much. I really enjoy sort of having a foot in both the music world and the psychology world and being able to bring the two of those together. And it was actually my music studies that inspired me to study psychology and go to university and pursue that, because I was really interested in the mechanisms of the mind and the brain and how we learn, how we commit information to memory, how we can practice certain tasks in different ways to become better at them and to eventually master them. And I think being a psychologist and a musician has really taught me a lot about those areas of how we can practice particular tasks to become better at them or more successful at them, how we can learn and the different sort of learning styles that people have, how we can work to remember information more effectively and more efficiently. But most of my interest there has been around learning and in the domain of performance, different ways in which we can learn. So I think this really applies to lots of different areas in life as well. If we have a particular task that we're struggling with, breaking it down into the smallest step, working on it consistently, dividing it into a small component so that we can really hone in on that particular section and work on it. This is something that I've done a lot with my music practice, and as a teacher and as a coach, I encourage those that I work with to do the same. But even in other areas of my life, if I remember being at university, if there was ever something that I was, you know, a concept that I was not really quite getting or struggling with, it's about breaking it down into the smallest task and working on it from there.
We see this in action because I watch your videos and your stories that you post on Instagram of you practicing, even though you are already a very accomplished pianist. Watching you actually has been fascinating for me, that process of just practicing the basic skills or having to practice and repractice and repractice a sequence so that you really get it to be as perfect as you want or need it to be.
Absolutely. And working on something in a way which actually makes it harder than what you need it to be. So for example, with a lot of my students, they know and they dread lessons where I make them play with their eyes closed, because my motto there is, well, if you can play it with your eyes closed, you can play it with your eyes open. And I think just in a lot of different ways, if we can become really good at doing a task in a way where it's actually harder than what we need it to be, then it makes doing it at the level that we need it to be a bit more effortless.
There is a lovely quote, and it's not coming to mind, but I'll look it up, about that process, isn't it? You may remember it. It's something about practicing so that it's impossible to fail.
Yeah, absolutely. Practicing so that we make it harder for ourselves to fail. Practicing in a way where it's more difficult, so that then when we do what we actually are required to do, it seems easier.
And where did your, you said that you got into psychology because of your music and because of this kind of thinking about how you learn and how you remember and how you develop the skills that you need to be able to perform. Where did your musical career start?
Yeah, so I started learning the piano when I was 3 years old, and by the age of 4, I was entering Stedfords, and then I think at 6, I had my first performance at the Opera House as a soloist. So it was something I've grown up with. It's been a part of my life since I was very, very young. I then did my diplomas in music performance, and when I went to university, I studied Bachelor of Psychology alongside with a Master's in Music. So I've always had the music running alongside my studies.
Sounds like they've been very closely interwoven, particularly as you got to the university years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so do you come from a musical family? Is that where this, because most of us don't start piano lessons at 3. What was kind of, you know, prompted that?
Yeah, actually not at all. No one in my family plays music, but I think it was my mother's thinking that she wanted to give me something to be a bit more occupied with. I was an only child, and she thought, well, better start now and see where this goes. And thankfully it's been a really great process for me. And it is something that I think in hindsight has been really great starting at a young age. And when I work with students, I always think the younger, the better that they start. As a young kid, first of all, you've got maybe a bit more time to dedicate to developing your skills, as opposed to once you reach high school and there's lots of studies and other demands there. But also, kids are just really good at learning, that anything you give them with some practice and with some skill, they can do it. I'm constantly surprised. I shouldn't be, but I am.
And so you teach little kids?
Yeah, so I'll take on students as young as 3.
Having had that experience yourself, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that learning thing came through there as well. That idea, and I know because I've observed it with my kids as well, that they do seem to pick up things, particularly if they're interested in it. You know, if they're not particularly interested, they'll just, you know, yeah, whatever, mum. But if they're interested in something, you know, they do engage in it. What, you know, as a psychologist, what do you think is going on there? Why is it so easy for kids to learn?
Yeah, I think what you just highlighted there is such a key point, making it interesting and engaging for kids. And even as a psychologist, because my PhD is in the area of working with children with intellectual disabilities, it's about how can we make the process of therapy fun and engaging. I think no matter what we want the child to be doing, making it or presenting it in a way that's going to be really fun for them, that's going to be easy for them to commit to it and they really enjoy it, is going to make them more motivated to want to then go away and practice and do it.
Yeah, and is that what worked for you? Did you have wonderful teachers who made it interesting and engaging?
Yes, absolutely. I had the same teacher from 3 years old all the way through my music career and finishing my diplomas. And I remember at one point when I was quite young, I was maybe 5 or 6 years old and getting a bit of bored of piano practice. And my teacher was like, okay, right, we're going to put pause on the pieces that we're learning at the moment. And what's your favourite Disney movie? Let's go and play some of the songs from the Disney movies that you like. So I remember learning A Whole New World from Aladdin. And that just kind of sparked my interest in it again, because it was, you know, a way that was engaging and fun for me and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that. I was actually just listening to a podcast this morning and the podcaster was interviewing a teacher and they were talking about, you know, teaching, and I think she's a school counselor. I'll find the name of it and put it in the show notes. But the teacher she was interviewing was a history teacher, or is a history teacher, teaches American history in a US school, and he dresses up as the characters that he's teaching, you know, and you could hear just in the part that I listened to the passion that came through for him. And he talked about, you know, why it was that he would dress up and go into class as the particular character that he was talking about. And he said that it was exactly that, that it was about finding a way that made it fun and engaging and interesting and used storytelling in order to kind of excite and inspire the kids. And it sounds like that has been your experience too.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that's really important when working with children, but also something we need to remember even as adults, that it's important for us to keep working on tasks in a way that's going to be more engaging for us. Having that variety is really important. I know when I do my own practice, I'll try and practice something in a number of different ways, even if it might not be how it's needed to be done, just to give myself some variety and keep it interesting and, you know, keep me attentive to what I'm doing.
So those old or the old fashioned notions, perhaps, I know I did a little bit of music when I was at school, and there was a tendency for teachers to suggest it's just slog. And I suppose that's the same with lots of things that we work in, you know, that if I'll just keep slogging away at it and eventually I'll get there. But it's not how our brains really like to do things, is it?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay. And for you, I mean, you've had all this experience as a performer from a very young age. I mean, I can't even imagine what it must be like to be a six-year-old performing a solo at the Sydney Opera House. That's not something that most of us will do even at 46 or 56. So you've had a lot of experience. What is performance in your mind from a psychological point of view?
Yeah, so I like to think of performance as any sort of task or activity that we're carrying out that requires some sort of preparation or rehearsal or practice, and also has some sort of element of evaluation there. So as a performer, it's often, you know, maybe you're going for a recital, you need to prepare your repertoire, and the evaluation that might come is, you know, how the audience perceives it. The same also applies if you're sitting an exam, you're preparing your repertoire for the exam, but then at the end of that, you get some sort of mark. So it's got both of these elements to it.
Okay. So for me as a workplace psychologist, it's all my people and myself, I include this, you know, who perhaps delivering a workshop or a presentation to somebody. So you put the prep in, you have to perform, you know, actually enact the task, and then you hope for some positive feedback at the end. That's your evaluation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think aside from sort of musical type performance, it's something that's quite common in our everyday life. And for many people in their jobs, they might have team meetings that they're going to where they have to, you know, present the figures for the end of the financial year and stand up with a presentation and talk about that. Or even in day-to-day life, you might be giving a speech for the best man at the wedding, or, you know, lots of different scenarios where we do have to prepare something and there is this sort of element of evaluation that comes from it.
I was speaking to one of the earlier episodes for this season. I spoke to Caroline Anderson, who's a psych and also a past Olympian. And so she kind of, from an athletic point of view, phrased it as being something that you're doing in a kind of a high stakes environment. I suppose that's an element of what you're talking about as well, isn't it? That evaluation, that there's something in it that could make a difference, you know, to your work, your career, your even just sense of self perhaps on the day.
Absolutely. There's something in it. I think even as psychologists, you know, we might be sitting in the room with a client and we've done some sort of preparation for the session, and the evaluation or what's in it is sort of how the client takes that information, how they progress with therapy, etc. So I think sometimes people think of performance in sort of this large scale sense, standing in front of a, you know, audience full of people, but even in our day-to-day lives, there is this constant element of performance that we do come across.
Yeah, I'm starting to think over all the kind of individuals that I work with and workplaces that I work with, and even perhaps a customer service staff who, you know, might be sitting at the front desk and they have somebody come in, you know, unhappy about a situation or the service from the organisation, and the individual therefore has to kind of, you know, in the moment, front up, be able to perhaps calm the individual down, explain what the situation is, and then the evaluation component would be what the outcome of that interaction might be. Do they go away happy or do they not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So what is performance anxiety?
Yeah, so performance anxiety is this sort of nervousness or anxiousness that people might feel in anticipation before we're actually carrying out that performance, and also sometimes during the performance as well. So for some people, the nervousness will be there just beforehand, and then once they actually start to deliver that speech or they're in the performance, the anxiety kind of goes and they can really focus on what they're doing. But for other people, it does kind of carry through the performance as well. And that's often when it can be quite unhelpful.
Okay. And when I'm thinking about my own experience, I had to deliver a workshop recently, and, you know, I do this fairly frequently now. It was a big group. It's about 120 people, I think. Not the biggest group I've spoken to, but not the smallest either. And I always, and I've used this analogy with my son, who has been performing particularly in the sporting arena lately. And I say, you know, you need those nerves, you need that energy to be able to perform. You know, if we didn't have that kind of stress response, then we wouldn't ever do anything. We'd lay in bed all day. I don't know, but we kind of need that performance. And I actually, for one of the, and it's unusual for me, but in this instance, I did, some of those nerves did carry through. I could hear it in my voice. I could hear that kind of nervous tone, and my mind started suddenly going into that. What's going on? Why am I still feeling this? Why am I still anxious? I should be into performance mode now. It did dissipate, but it was unusual for me. And it, are those the sorts of things that somebody who's struggling with performance anxiety might be feeling?
Yes, absolutely. As you were saying, you know, through the performance or through the presentation, if we start having these sort of more self-reflective thoughts where we're really quite internal in our processes rather than focusing on what's happening around us and maybe using some of those mindfulness type skills, that's when it can become quite problematic if we've just sort of got this internal dialogue that's not really helpful for us. And I absolutely love what you said about how nerves are actually a good thing and can really help us, because that's the first thing that I always work on with people. If I'm working with musicians or performers of any sort who do have this nervousness and anxiety, they might come in and say, you know, I've got X presentation or performance coming up and I feel really nervous. And my response is, well, yeah, okay. And you know, people have this misconception that nerves are a bad thing, and they're really not. I encourage people to make friends with nerves. They're not a bad thing. If we kind of stop and reflect on why we feel nervous, we realize that, you know, as with many emotions, they give us a message. And the message here is that what I'm about to do is actually really important to me. I care about what I'm about to do. It's of importance. That's why I feel nervous. You know, I've maybe dedicated a lot of time and energy into preparing this performance to go out on stage and perform it. And I want people to like it. And I want, you know, them to clap at the end and to think that it was great. I really care about what I'm doing. That's why I feel nervous. So I think the first step is to kind of make friends with nerves. Don't worry when they show up, but actually be like, well, yeah, of course I'm going to feel nervous. This is important to me.
Yeah, I like that care factor piece. That's not something I've used with my son before, but it does make sense, because he just had this huge weekend where he was participating in his interschool athletics, and he wanted to get through to the next level, which is the regional, in his two events. He then had a basketball grand final, which, you know, they've had a really big season. And these are little kids. He's 10, but, you know, in his world, that is really important. And it was kind of important for the families too. You know, we've invested a lot of time into the season. And then he had a swim carnival in the afternoon where, and he had success last year and he wanted to be able to replicate this success this year. And we did talk about the role of nerves in performance, and the fact that he needed them. But that element of, you know, I feel nervous because it's something I care about, you know, it's something that's important to me, is something we hadn't touched on. So I'll use that as a strategy next time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you were to go out to the swimming race and not really care if he came first or last or what his time was, he probably wouldn't feel nervous. If it's something we don't really care about, we don't have those same nerves. So I like to try and reframe it as, well, of course I'm going to feel nervous. This is to be expected because I really care about this and it's really important to me and who I am and the things that I want to achieve.
And do you find that helps people when you're talking to them and just giving that kind of, I suppose, a different way of thinking about it? Is that the first step in helping to relieve some of that performance anxiety?
Yes, absolutely. I think for a lot of people, it's not something that they've thought of before. They've always had this misconception of nerves are bad. So when nerves show up, I start thinking, oh my goodness, I feel nervous. This is not good. I'm going to start to shake, et cetera, et cetera. So it's basically just reframing that relationship that we have with nerves and not seeing them as something detrimental or bad or that might hinder our performance, but that can actually really help us.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that we don't, so, you know, if we're watching somebody perform, we don't see the nerves necessarily, you know, particularly if they're an accomplished performer and they've been able to develop the skills to kind of overcome that anxiety initially. I know for me, I always, you know, I watch a lot of TED Talks and I see these people get up and they just, you know, they're able to speak so eloquently and so passionately about their topic and there's no notes and they do it all. And I often think, you know, you set your own internal standard and then think, oh, well, when I get up and speak, you know, I should be able to do that too. And then I can't. But I have to refer to my notes or I do, you know, feel like I stumble. And those sort of expectations, I'm guessing, play a role in this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think comparing ourselves to other people or expecting us to do something perfectly. And when we think about performance, whether it's giving a workshop or a presentation or a recital on a stage, there's no such thing as the perfect performance. There can be really great performances and there can be performances where we make mistakes and it doesn't go so well, but there's really no perfect performance, especially in the sort of music world where, you know, there's lots of different interpretations of things and sometimes some people in the audience may like what we do and sometimes they won't, and that's just what happens. We don't necessarily like every single song that we hear. So we shouldn't maybe expect everyone else to absolutely love what we do.
Yeah, that's a different element, I guess, for musicians and performers, perhaps in some of the arts that may not apply as readily to athletics or sport. You know, if you've come first, second or third in a race and maybe you don't feel that you've run the best race that you could have, but from an outsider's perspective looking in, you say, yeah, they came first, that's great. But yeah, for something like music, you're right, there's a lot of different and nuanced interpretation. It's not as clear cut. Does that play a role in people's kind of anxiety? Is that an issue for performers in those domains?
Well, clearly, I think often that comes about more for people who are of quite a high level. So maybe already have a somewhat established career in the music industry. There are certainly times where people may be involved in competitions, music competitions. And again, that can be really tricky because it's not just who crosses the finish line first, but it's all about interpretation and technique. And do the judges like your interpretation? And one judge might like yours better than the other person's and vice versa for another judge. So there is always this element of ambiguity and interpretation that's involved with music performance. And I think to a degree, it's something that we just need to be accepting of, that we won't always give a performance that every single person in the room will think is absolutely brilliant. Just as if we were listening to a song or a performance, we might have our own ideas and interpretations about it.
Yeah. So we've talked about the role of nerves and this kind of anxiety that you might have before you perform a task. Where does that go wrong? Where does that become really problematic?
Yeah. So I think first way in which it becomes problematic is when people put too much negative emphasis on that nervousness. So they notice the nerves show up for them, perhaps before a performance or a recital, and they interpret that in a really negative way, thinking this is going to have a negative impact on me. My hands might start shaking. I might, you know, if I'm singing, I might forget the words or I might forget the notes. And what if nobody in the audience likes what I do? Or what if I don't pass the exam? So it's this really anxious thinking style that comes up, but it's got that negative element to it, as opposed to thinking of, well, actually, nerves can be really helpful for me. We know, so I think one of the important things to do is educating people about the role of nerves. We know that nervousness can actually be really beneficial. If we have rehearsed what we're doing to the point where we are quite good at it, then nerves will help us on the day. And I think this is where it can go wrong for some people. They maybe are doing the practice, they're putting in the hours and the dedication and the rehearsal time, But then when they get on stage, they don't give their best performance. And that's where we really want to try and intervene, because there's no point giving the best performance when you're at home in the living room and no one's there to hear it. You know, when it really counts is when you're on that stage. So that's what we've got to be working towards. So it's about shifting this mindset around nerves and actually realizing that research tells us they can really help us. I know from personal experience that the times I have been most nervous have actually been my best performances, and vice versa, when I have been not really nervous at all, they've probably been some of my worst performances. So nowadays, and in the last few years, I would, if I noticed I wasn't quite really that nervous beforehand, I would purposely sort of rile myself up beforehand. You know how many people, if they're anxious about something, they'll sort of shake their leg. If they're sitting down, they'll sort of shake their leg. I used to sit backstage and do that, like shake my legs to
actually create a bit of psychomotor agitation.
That's it. I wanted to induce the sort of that energy that comes from nervousness. And when I was young, my piano teacher would actually tell my mum that the morning of concerts or competitions, I would have chocolate and Coke for breakfast. as a little kid, I didn't maybe understand the situation and perhaps the stakes to really feel nerves. So I'd get that energy in other ways by eating chocolate and drinking Coke. So,
you probably thought that was pretty good.
Yes.
I know my kids would.
So there is really something to be said for just channeling those nerves in the right way, and that they can be really helpful for us.
Okay. So I'm interested because, as I said before, you know, that instance I had recently where I was feeling more nervous than I ordinarily would, and I did hear that kind of nervousness in my voice, and I felt the sweaty palms. And my thought processes, and I was, you know, it was internalizing. I'm starting to think, but I know, because I'm a psychologist, that if I allowed my brain to follow down that path, it was going to make it worse, not better. So how do you advise people to kind of harness that thinking side? Because it is that it can lead to panic, can't it? And actually then, you know, completely stop your performance in its tracks potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that stop and freeze kind of moment is something that some performers have experienced if they do have that really bad anxiety, forgetting the notes or forgetting the words when you're on stage. And unfortunately, this is a really strong negative emotional experience that we can have, and it can stop people then going on to perform again. So in the moment, during the performance, we really want to be harnessing those mindfulness skills. So being in the moment, very present and without judgment, not judging what I'm doing. I'm trying to do the best that I can. I'm doing what I've rehearsed lots of times over, but really focusing on those external aspects. So often when I'm performing, I sort of described it once as I'm not really thinking, but I'm just sort of singing along in my head to what's happening. And it's that sort of mindfulness that we really want to utilize, just being really present. If it's a music performance, present by listening, not having that internal thought process. Something that can often come up for people is, and I know this has come up for myself as well, if there's a particular spot where maybe we've made mistakes in the past, or particular spot in the music that's quite challenging, kind of 30 seconds beforehand, we start thinking, okay, there's that place, it's coming up again. I hope I get it right this time. What if I don't get it right? And that, you know, the more we think that, the more likely we are to make a mistake.
So trying to some extent, shut all that thinking down, shut that worrying down, remaining in the moment and perhaps finding something. So you said for musicians that might be listening to the music, finding something that kind of anchors you in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a big part of this process also happens before the performance. So not just while we're in there trying to sort of manage any of these thoughts, but setting ourselves up right. So I think this is something that's often done in sports psychology as well, but this process of visualization before going and performing. So I often encourage people to start this maybe even at least 2 weeks before a performance, but closing their eyes and imagining them going out and giving that performance the best they've ever done it. Because if we've had experiences where performances haven't gone well for us, those are really strong negative emotional experiences. And we know that the brain is, you know, not always the best at distinguishing between what's imagined versus what's real life. So we want to create really positive emotional experiences. So when I do this for myself, it's in a very detailed way. I'll close my eyes, imagine me sitting backstage before going out, looking out into the audience, noticing the shining lights, really using those skills to notice what that scene might look like. And then imagining myself giving the best performance I have ever given. And at the end of it, the audience stands up and there's a standing ovation and they throw flowers onto the stage and all the rest of it, which, you know, no one's ever really thrown flowers on a stage before for me, but it's just inducing this really positive emotional experience. And that's really important because even by imagining some of these situations, we do get that slight nervousness that can come up for us. So all we're doing is teaching our brain to deal with it in a different way.
Okay, so attaching positive emotions and positive thoughts, I guess, to those physical feelings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to try that now. I do imagine myself giving TED Talks.
Fantastic. That's nice.
I'm not sure I do it in quite the level of detail I need to, though. So I think that's what I'm going to work on is actually doing that kind of real level of you know, detail where I get down to the nitty gritty. My brain gets a bit bored really quickly and it goes, yeah, we know all that, and moves on. But yeah, I'll try a little harder, see how I go.
And I think when I do it and when I do it with musicians, it's not necessarily mentally rehearsing every single note you might play, but the overall sense that you want. So I'll imagine that my fingers are sort of really effortlessly playing along the piano and that all my musical interpretation is really fantastic and that there's lots of emotion and dynamic and all the rest of it, rather than actually imagining me playing every single note.
Okay, so it is very much conjuring up the feelings and that kind of deeper level. Yeah, okay, I probably do that, I think. I'm going to think about that now. You've given me something to work on for my next presentation and think about how I get into the kind of, and I guess that's mental rehearsal, isn't it? You know, that you talked about the importance of practice and physical rehearsal, but that's a mental rehearsal process that goes along with it.
Absolutely, because the physical practice will only get us so far. And if mentally we're not prepared for what we're about to do, we run the risk of not giving that best performance or not reaching our potential in the way that we could. So it's something that I think, particularly for musicians I've come across, it's not really something that is discussed or taught, which is this mental preparation and how to be ready for those performances and how to harness those nerves and the emotions that we have so that we are giving our best performance. There's a lot of focus on the practical side of practicing, but maybe not the mental rehearsal that we do sometimes need.
There's not enough psychologists in the musical field, obviously. That's your niche. So, Anastasia, you do this performance coaching. This is part of a role that you play for other performers and a service that you provide us as psychologists. Can you tell us, I think you've probably, you know, give us some great descriptions of what that's like, but is there any other components to it that you provide to people?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of what I've discussed around changing our mindset, understanding what nerves are, how they can help us, how they can sometimes not help us, and really applying that to the individual person is what I work on doing. And then using those sorts of strategies to assist them to give their best performance possible. So working on mindfulness skills, teaching the person what is mindfulness and how can we apply it to these particular performances. Doing the sort of mental rehearsal and preparation, looking at challenging any sort of unhelpful thoughts and cognitions that might pop up for us beforehand. I often work with people as well who have maybe a little bit more severe anxiety before these performances on making a bit of a list of a reminder of, well, actually, look, I've dedicated so many hours to lessons and so many hours to practicing and all this time and effort that I've put in and all these great performances that I've had in the past, because we can sometimes fall into the trap of having this negativity bias. So if there's, you know, one performance that didn't go quite well, we really focus on that one and forget the 10 or 50 or however many that actually did go really well. So sometimes just before going out on stage, having that little list to read through can be quite helpful, or even some sort of little mantra to remind yourself of, just some sort of positive encouragement beforehand. So I work with people looking at how can we apply these skills in a way that's going to be most helpful for them.
Okay, beautiful. That self-talk component, just as you were talking about that, I was thinking, yeah, that's part of what I do before I go up and speak in front of a group, is that little message, you know what you're talking about, you can do this, you've done this plenty of times before.
Yes, absolutely. It's so important to remind ourselves of that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so wonderful. And as you said earlier, these are all skills and knowledge and tips and tools that can be used not just for musicians or people who get up on stage, but for lots of different domains in life.
Yes, absolutely. If you've got, you know, a team meeting where you're a bit nervous about giving a presentation, running it through in your mind beforehand, imagining it going really well and what that outcome might be like, you know, reminding yourself of successes that you've had in the past if you've got something coming up, or times where you maybe have spoken in public or run a really good workshop or session and it's been really well received. Just keeping a little notebook or a little list of these things to remind ourselves of them.
Mm, that past success thing is so important, isn't it? That, mm-hmm. you know, counteracting that, as you say, the negativity bias. I was speaking to a colleague the other day about giving presentations or workshops and getting feedback at the end, and how our brain automatically focuses on, you know, you might get 20 pieces of feedback and 19 of them are really positive, and you get one that is, you know, not even particularly negative. It just might be slightly negative, constructive feedback, but your brain just automatically goes to that one and dwells on that one. And, you know, why did they say that? And what did I do wrong? And we do just discount all that positive feedback and information, don't we?
Yeah, it's so easy to do, to just sort of put all the good stuff aside, all the good feedback aside, and really focus and dwell and ruminate on that one negative feedback comment or experience that we've had.
Our crazy, unhelpful brains. Now, we've talked a lot about the performance role that you play, or assisting people with performance as a psychologist, but there's a related concept, which is social anxiety, which I believe you work with individuals as part of your more clinical psychological practice around social anxiety. What is social anxiety?
Yeah, so social anxiety is very related to this performance anxiety that we've been talking about as well, particularly in the way that we maybe expect or perceive negative judgment or evaluation from other people. So in the performance sense, we might be worried about how the performance goes and how other people might evaluate us. But in terms of social anxiety, we're thinking about being worried about how other people in a social interaction or encounter might judge us or might think negatively of us. So it's really about working with individuals who have that social anxiety to challenge, again, that unhelpful thinking, working from more of a cognitive behavior therapy framework, and working on these internal processes that can happen as well. So if we're, you know, at dinner talking to some people, instead of being engaged in the conversation, someone with social anxiety might be thinking, oh, I've got nothing interesting to say. What if they don't like me? What if they're judging the clothes that I'm wearing? What if they can notice that I'm feeling anxious? So we have this internal process that goes on, which unfortunately can sometimes reinforce what we're worried about. If we're worried about coming across as perhaps not interesting or not having things to contribute to a conversation, the more we withdraw from the conversation and focus on what's happening within ourselves, the less we will have to contribute.
Yep.
So it can kind of reinforce itself in a way. So it's about breaking this cycle and helping clients to see how that cycle develops and how we can break out of it.
It is interesting, that notion of social anxiety. I did actually listen to a podcast, I think it was the Psychology Podcast recently, with Dr. Ellen Hendrickson was talking about that concept. And she said, yeah, that this getting so caught up in our own mind, and it does parallel what you're talking about in terms of the performance anxiety, isn't it? Sort of noticing the nerves, noticing what you're worried about, starting to get caught up in those thoughts, letting that run away with us to a point where we can't perform, whether that's even in a conversation versus being on stage.
Yeah. And in the performance sense, it's more about worrying about the performance that we're giving and how that's perceived. Whereas in the social anxiety sense, we're worried, it's more personal in a way. We're worried about that personal judgment. What will they think of me? What will they think of what I'm saying? How does this reflect on me personally, as opposed to how does this reflect on the performance that I'm giving?
Okay. So real sense of personal judgment.
Absolutely.
And that I can only imagine would be very limiting for people who are really struggling with this. It would make life very difficult.
Yes, it makes it hard to make friends. It makes it hard to go to the work drinks after work. It makes it hard to engage in conversations with people. It makes it hard to maybe go out and date and find a partner. It can really limit people if it is quite severe.
Okay, and so what are your tips and suggestions? Because I think we probably all experience at least mild elements of that social anxiety, particularly perhaps if we're in an environment where we're not comfortable, or it's new, or we don't know the people so well, or it's very important. I guess that evaluation is, I need to make a good impression here. If I'm at a networking event, for example, what are the tips and strategies that you recommend to people to be able to deal with those thoughts and feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. So if it's in a milder sense, either trying to use some sort of mindfulness skills and just be in the present moment and really engage with what's going on around us, or trying to sort of challenge some of that thinking that can come up for us. Sometimes that can be a little bit more difficult to do if we haven't sort of sat down and worked it through with a psychologist. But a lot of the times where we're assuming we know what the other person might be thinking, when in actual fact we can't really know what the other person's thinking unless they say it to us. So we make these unhelpful assumptions. Being able to pick up on when we're doing this is really important, and being able to remind ourselves, well, hey, I'm just thinking that. I think that person's judging me, or I think they might think something negative about me, but I don't actually know that for a fact. For all I know, they could be thinking something really positive. So being able to pick up on our thoughts and our thought processes, and really challenging firstly whether they're true, and secondly whether they're helpful for us. Is this actually helping me achieve my goals in this situation? If I'm at a networking event, I want to try and make a good impression and interact with people and maybe collaborate on some things in the future. So by me thinking that they're all judging me, that's not helping me work towards my goal. So really picking up on those thought patterns and working with those, trying to be as flexible as we can with those.
And I think that's something, and I know I've spoken to a couple of other people on the podcast about that, that notion that we have all these thoughts that run through our mind that can help us or they can hinder us. Yeah. And the fact that I don't think we talk often enough about that, you know, it has such an impact on our experience of the world and our ability to do the things that we want to do. If we have a little kind of monologue going on in our mind that says, you know, oh no, you're doing that wrong, or that person thinks this about you, that will instantly have an impact on the way we feel and therefore the way we behave. But being able to be conscious of those thoughts and to intervene before they start to impact our behavior in an unhelpful way is so critical, isn't it?
Yes, it's this idea that we don't have to believe everything that our mind tells us or everything that we think. Not everything we think is true. It's not always fact. So we don't need to buy into it and believe it.
Yeah, we do have an imperfect mind. Anastasia, look, I've picked up so many tips from you about my own performance, and also, you know, as a parent talking to my kids when they're required to perform, because I think that is something that actually, you know, I've even noticed has changed with education since I was a kid. It was a long time ago that, you know, with our primary school, the kids are expected to get up and perform in front of the school. They get up and give little speeches. They get up and do class events where they, you know, show off their singing or their dancing. I think there's probably maybe more expectation that we'd be able to perform, which I think is a wonderful skill for kids to be able to learn. But as a parent, you know, being able to guide them through that if they are anxious and worried about it, I think is a really, there's some great tips that you've provided me to be able to help my kids with that. If people want to learn more about you and your performance coaching and indeed your music, where will they find you?
Yes, so I have a website which they can visit, which is www.anastasiaharonis.com.au. And in terms of the music sort of consultations and coaching that I do, for performers, I do a lot of online sessions as well through Skype and Zoom, etc. So I work with people all around Australia and sometimes around the world as well, which is really nice and exciting, especially for me. So I can be reached through my website. In terms of music as well, a lot of that is through social media, where I often put up tips and performance strategies and practice techniques and things like that through Instagram, which is, again, Anastasia Hieronis.
Wonderful. And yes, I do watch and I listen. I always have to put the sound up. So, oh, Anastasia's playing. I'm going to listen in. So, yeah, look, you know, anyone who even wants to appreciate beautiful music, that's a great place to find you and to listen in. And I will put all of the details of your website and your social links in the show notes for this episode. Thank you again for all of the insights you've given us. I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure, quite confident, that all my lovely listeners out there are going to be able to pick up on some tips and strategies that they can use in terms of their everyday performance.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really wonderful talking to you about this.
Thank you very much. Hey, thanks for listening, you fabulous person, you. You are the reason that I make these podcasts, so I hope that you have walked away from this episode with some tips that you can use for upping your performance game. If you're listening via the Radio Public app today, thank you. An extra thank you for you. If you're not and you'd like to support the podcast further, listening via the Radio Public app sends a few shekels my way, and that helps to keep us on the air. You'll find a link to download the app in the podcast page of the Potential Psychology website. And while you're there, please take a look at the newly launched Potential Psychology store. I've filled it with resources designed to help you live, learn and flourish and fulfill your potential. You'll find my new ebook, The Positive Parenting Toolkit, a suite of discovery tests to enhance your self-awareness and make decisions easier. And you'll find two of my goal coaching programs, the short Stop Stalling 5-Step Goal Coaching Challenge and my fully fledged email coaching program, in which we interact weekly online over email to get you from where you are now to where you want to be, wherever that may be. If you get a moment, I'd also love it if you can take the time to rate and review the podcast in iTunes. I read every review. I love receiving your feedback, and it really helps us to know where we can improve. So it's time to find out what we're doing for next week's episode. My guest for next week is Dr. Melissa Moreau, who is a fellow coaching psychologist with a specialist interest in well-being and performance at work. Melissa will be talking to us about our psychological needs in the workplace and how to best manage ourselves and our stress levels to avoid burnout. Please join me for that interview next week. As always, thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I look forward to being with you next time.